I'm Christopher Lydon, looking back two generations in the politics of Islam. How much of the fury and the fear we connect with Muslim faith on fire in South Asia today can be traced to the bloody birth of the twins, India and Pakistan, in 1947. This is Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University, an American conversation with global attitude, we call it. Vazira Zamindar is our guest, historian at Brown University of the long partition of India and Pakistan, the making of modern South Asia in her subtitle, but it's also the making of a lethal modern mix of religion and statehood, brutal ethnic cleansing, multi-millions of identity crises that seem never to go away. Professor Zamindar, we seem to be talking about a wound that keeps on wounding. Take us back. What's this about? Why doesn't it heal?
To describe partition as a wound, I think it's a wound that's been deeply felt within people. It's a severing of a part of themselves, which is why the wound has not healed. I think for many people in parts of North India, as well as certainly Pakistan and Bangladesh, there were political boundaries that were drawn, which cut right through their hearts, their homes, their kin networks, their pilgrim networks, their religious networks. And so in that sense, it is a wound within ourselves, within each person. One of the things that always strikes me about discussions when they take place on the partition of 1947, and particularly in a comparative framework with, say, Israel and Palestine, with scholars of Ireland, or more recent partitions, Bosnia, what's striking is the kind of affinity Indians and Pakistanis in the group will immediately find. There's so much connection. There's so much affection. There's language, there's humor, there's so much shared culture. In fact, when you cross the very, very difficult political borders between India and Pakistan, you can very quickly forget that you are in another country, that you are in enemy country. You can forget that entirely because the street culture, the humor, the colors, the kinds of everyday struggles and conflicts, you know, a street fight, look very similar in both countries. Violence against women looks very similar in both countries, you know, very similar family formations and political cultures at that level. There's a lot of affinity, and yet there are differences, and differences that have emerged over the 60-plus years now of the partition of 1947.
Can I say, I didn't know before your book, Vazira, how new, in some ways, these identity questions of India, Pakistan, Karachi or Delhi, even Hindu, Muslim, were sort of thrust upon people who had suddenly to decide who they were and what the priority of these labels was. It's a very confusing process, and I take it, it burst afresh on people.
I think what's really important to remember, and something that's easily forgotten today, is that the whole region was a multi-religious society.
Exactly.
And people lived together. Not always peacefully, as in any society, there are conflicts. There may be class conflicts and ethnic conflicts and resource conflicts, which often got translated in terms of religious boundaries. So it's not a place where there weren't conflicts, but it was a profoundly multi-religious society. So any project to create a Muslim Pakistan or a Hindu India would necessarily have to be an extremely violent one. And I don't think political leaders knew what this partition was actually going to mean on the ground. Certainly, we have leaders, including Muhammad Ali Jinnah, the architect of the Pakistan idea, And so the leader of the Muslim League and the Pakistan movement himself maintained his home in Bombay, didn't want to transfer his property. Imagine he would retire to Bombay after the end of his political career. So I think the large amount of ambiguity lay in the fact that it was presumed that the territories that would be Pakistan would continue to be multi-religious society. And the territories that would be India would continue to be multi-religious as well. That there wouldn't have been this mass migration, that people would continue to live where they were. And they had various vague notions of how peoples and cultures would continue to remain connected and yet divided. Was this meant to be an international political boundary in the way that it unfolded? Was it supposed to prevent people from moving from one place to another? All of those questions were extremely unclear, vague, and open-ended, which allowed many people to imagine many different things, you know. So Pakistan meant an array of different things to different groups of people. It was almost a mythical place for some that only heard it in slogans but didn't live in the territories that would become Pakistan. And for the peoples that lived in the territories that would become Pakistan, was still this ambiguous idea.
There was ambiguity, too, in Jinnah's notion of a state that would be a home for the Muslims of South Asia, as opposed to or different from a state whose design was to honor the Prophet. I mean, the degree of religiousness of the new state is something that people not only still argue about, but they argue about Jinnah's intentions. Whose idea was it to separate the two peoples in the first place?
The colonial context of this decision is extremely important, unmistakably important.
And the Brits.
The British saw all conflict or read all conflict primarily in terms of religious conflict, as between two opposed religious identities, in particular Hindus and Muslims. Thus, the political solution of partition seemed within the realm of possibilities. So you have to take into account that colonial conditions played in the long durée as well an important role in then this even being proposed as a solution.
It was a top-down decision, meaning a colonial decision, and at the very highest level of the Gandhis and the Nehrus and the Jinnahs of the world. If Indians on the ground had been making the decision on their own, would partition ever have been a solution?
That's a very interesting question. And I wish there had been universal franchise when electoral mandates were expanded in British India. My own sense is no, that would not have happened. I think the way people actually live on the ground, although there are seemingly distinct religious identities, there's a whole array of gray areas in between a Muslim, Hindu, and any other religious identity in the region. The ways in which people live, they live with a heterodox of practices. And on an everyday basis, people learn to live together in ways that governments don't learn to live together, right? So I'm not sure how people would have voted, what the options might have been. Certainly, there were a number of different ideas of how Muslims could be accommodated in a united India. I would go so far as to argue that in 1947, when that political decision was made, it was still unclear that how these two entities called India and Pakistan would inscribe themselves as two nation states in this landscape. I think it is the following decade that's quite decisive, though, the following decades And one could go so far as to say that it is still an ongoing process of creating this distinction, the need to constantly articulate this distinction through hostility, through enmity, through making the border between these two states almost impossible for citizens of the region to cross. I don't want to say almost impossible because people are crossing it all the time and getting arrested. But I mean, there is a line on the ground that that disappears very quickly. When people cross it, there's a line on the ground which disappears very quickly when people cross it. And that's, I think, a reality for the region. On an everyday basis, people are much more accommodating of difference. We readily think of conflict being around religious boundaries, but I think those conflicts are produced through political process. And the kinds of violence that the nation states can carry out as states with huge armies and nuclear weapons now requires us to reinvest in, I think, the political imagination, the social imagination, and the cultural imagination of people in the region and on the ground.
I'd like you to look at it in two different ways, both the public and the private. Start with the public. When you read, say, of the frenzied fundamentalism that kills the governor of the Punjab state in Pakistan, Mr. Taseer, by his own security guard, over issues of, you know, a state ban on blasphemy against the prophet, but a very ugly, wounding event. In what ways do you trace something like that to the original sins of partition?
The religious scholars, the ulama, so to speak, in 47, by and large, were against the partition of 1947 on the grounds that this would not be a solution for the Muslims of South Asia, that they had lived for a long time in a multi-religious society. And this was not a solution that they proposed. So it is the more secular Muslims, so to speak, like Jinnah, who are part of the Pakistan movement. The fact that the idea for Pakistan did not come from from Muslim religious sphere, but really from the secular political sphere.
To what end?
I think is really important to remember, because what happens post-1947, and Farzana Sheikh is a historian who's made this argument the most forcefully in recent years, is that within the logic of creating Pakistan was necessarily the question of what should be the status of Islam or religion within this new state. So this remained an embattled question. An embattled question which was resolved at various points by a political leadership for its own ends, particularly the military, in many ways sponsored, supported religious groups, which in society had little, had support, but not necessarily support for defining political trajectory of the nation. But they are a group of people that have political voice because of a series of political decisions. And the same could be argued for India as well. There's a way in which the Hindu right has gained political presence through a man-made part. I mean, there's nothing natural about the existence of fundamentalists on either side of the border. They are a product of history and politics. And in the case of Pakistan in particular, I mean, it's very easy to see the rise of Islamic fundamentalists as a natural component to a state that's been created for the Muslims of South Asia. It's very easy to see that. And yet, the place of Islam in within the constitution, within the political society, has always been embattled. There's never been a consensus on this matter in that society. Nobody has voted for a theocracy in that region. And you do have events like Salman Taseer's murder and a celebration of the murderer, which is a horrific event. And one can take that event and say, well, it's a society of religious fundamentalists. So, of course, there's support for this murderer. But that's actually not true. There is a way in which religious fundamentalism has a political presence, and that political presence has been created through a particular history. It's not a natural part of that landscape. I mean, it's not necessarily what people feel and think and believe in that region.
How has Pakistan missed the opportunity to declare in a majority vote that it is not a religious state?
I think that's a failure of the political leadership, really. To put up such a popular vote, you need a political leadership that has the ability and the vision which comes from the people, that can speak for the aspirations of the people in the region. And that is missing. You don't have political leadership that can speak for the aspirations of the people. We do have there is a civilian government in Pakistan today. And the civilian government is almost in power because the military has agreed to do so, but controls foreign policy and the finance of the country. So what can the civilian government do? Can it decide which wars it wants to fight and doesn't want to fight? Can it decide how much money goes to the social sector versus the military, versus military spending? Civilian government can't make those absolutely critical decisions in that region. So what can it do? The power still rests with the military in that region, and that will remain the case as long as there's a war going on in Afghanistan, of which it is a party.
What's the cost to the human heart, and how many hours of a person's day are spent puzzling over, gnawing on the question of who am I?
I think for Pakistan in particular, which is now hostage to an India-Pakistan conflict, and a war in Afghanistan and on its borderlands, this question has increasing relevance because it's become so tied to everyday survival for many, many peoples in that region, and particularly the poorest.
But how connected to survival?
There's been growing impoverization in the region, hikes in food prices, and no jobs. So you want more money, more of the government's resources to go to the social sector for development. You want the country to be opened up to economic development and industrialization and other economic opportunities more widely in the region. End of wars would mean you could actually say, the enormous amounts of resources that goes to the military could be redirected to the social sector. That's simply right away. One way in which peace in the region would be of enormous benefit. The other is that transformations taking place in India, of which this region could be a part. And certainly ending the conflict with India would allow for connections and relationships to emerge in the region in perhaps unexpected and hopefully more positive ways.
Bazira, can I ask a kind of ignorant American question, but does anybody in India, Pakistan ever contemplate undoing the partition, like 60-some years with a bloody separation? Maybe the line should be erased, and a greater subcontinent with incredible diversity of language and religion already would have one more colorful stripe in it.
I'm not sure what that means. I do take the question, was partition of 1947 a mistake? I take that question as really a critique of our present, of our terrible, divided, embattled present. It's a critique of the present. It's a sign that people are just fed up with everything that's happening, and they don't want these wars, and they don't want these hostilities, and they don't want these endless conflicts. I want to hold on to that question as a sign that people still have an imagination for a multi-religious society that lives with all its ebbs and flows together. Whether the two states of India and Pakistan persist in perpetuity or not, what kind of states will they be? With what kinds of polities, what kinds of cultures will they have within them may be much more important. And if they are tolerant, multi-religious societies with visions of opportunity and progress for the poorest peoples of this region, then I think the path to peace will already be laid out for us between the states. I'm certain that if we can transform the visions of society, the priorities of society within the states, that the relation between the states will be a moot point altogether. It will be a region that can learn from each other, that lives together with each other.
You know, may I just say, with great respect, I want to believe every word of that. At the same time, I was just struck in India last year that the most reasonable, wonderful people in the world in India, at the mention of Pakistan, go a little bit crazy. And they talk about Pakistan as a ugly, evil, nasty, sick state, and they'd love nothing to do with it. Same people who are so proud of India as a multilingual, tolerant, diverse, wildly, you know, various place, they draw the line about Pakistan.
Right. And I think the reason for that is really the very little exposure to Pakistan or people in Pakistan that Indians have. There is much greater media access within Pakistan of, you know, so people in Pakistan watch Indian TV and movies and and they have and they're so critical of their own government that they certainly don't buy any of the political rhetoric from the Pakistani state as far as India is concerned. But I think in India, the media blackout on Pakistan, the very little reporting on Pakistan of what everyday life looks like in Pakistan means that people have much more stereotypical ideas about what Pakistan looks like or people in that part of the world, how similar they are to them. I do remember talking to a bunch of students from Delhi University that some years ago had made the journey to Pakistan. When they came back, they held a big meeting at Delhi University to share their experiences with other students. And everything that they had to say was, they wrote a number of newspaper articles as well at the time, actually. But they said the other side looked pretty much like the world that they knew in India. So they
like
went
home.
It looked like home. It felt like home. They had gone on the train from Delhi to Lahore. When they reached Lahore, it felt like home. Although the crossing at the border had been extremely difficult.
Interesting.
That Amritsar Lahore crossing is a long and arduous affair on the train. So the crossing had been incredibly different. When they reached Lahore, it they felt at home. And they were looking out for all the pretty girls in the market, which they'd heard so much about, the famous Lahori beauties. Anyway, so, and they were telling their stories. They were telling their stories to students in Delhi University. And some of the students got up and they said, well, you just had a particular experience, that your experience in Pakistan is not representative of what Pakistan's really like. Mm-hmm. Although these students were saying how familiar that part of the world was, they still resisted, they fought against the idea that it might be a familiar place. Mm-hmm. And so that is a barrier that needs to be overcome. But imagine if there was freedom of movement in the region. I mean, that's really being utopic in some sense. But I think one of the reasons why there are such acute restrictions on travel across that border is because that difference disappears so quickly when you cross it. So you've got to really have these enormous restrictions.
Yeah, if you're invested
to maintain, you know, this idea that there's a different place on the other side. But if there was freedom of movement in the region, if people could really go back and forth, you could hope for a shift in that kind of perception of Pakistan in India. And reduce the kind of belligerence and out of that hostile politics that may emerge. Mm. It may be a part of transformations of minds and hearts.
Vizira, I connect your book on the long partition and you with a lot of conversations we've had now focusing on Pakistan as the home address in the world of the killer fundamentalism that Americans worry about. Nuclear-armed fanaticism in a country that's much bigger and more dangerous than Iran, probably, not to mention Afghanistan, even though Pakistan is nominally a friend and an ally of the United States. But there's a history here.
This perception that you have put forward of Pakistan, that very perception means that our response to the conflicts in that region are shaped by that perception. If one was to think of that region just like any other poor part of the world, if one was to think of it as, say, Haiti, struck by natural disaster, with histories of military dictatorships, where people's aspirations have never been met, with the baggage of colonialism and so forth. If one was to perceive the region in a different way, then the solutions we would imagine for that region would be different. And I think it's time we do that. I think it's time we stop thinking about the place simply through this lens of jihadi fundamentalism, because really that jihadi fundamentalism has to be tied to a real war that's being fought in that region, a war that has very little to do with everyday ordinary people on the street, but which militaries are fighting and which certain sections of trained militants are fighting, which has little to do with ordinary people who are caught in the storm of the war. But if you were to stop seeing them through that rubric and just see them as people, just like you and me sitting in this room, trying to raise their children and give them an education and all the rest of it, the basic human aspirations with love and desire and longing in the same ways that we experience them. If we were only to start doing that, we would think about solutions for that region in a different way. We'd have aid boxes in every corner like we do for Haiti to put our pennies in for development and for change in the same ways that we would do for any other poor part of the world. I think it's time we just ask different questions of the region. Mm-hmm. Give that region the benefit of the doubt. And say, well, this is a place where there are human beings living just like us. Let's begin by responding to that region as a place, a familiar rather than alien to our worlds.
Wazira Zamindar, thank you for your work. Thank you for your book on the long partition. Thank you especially for this conversation.
Thank you, Chris. It's been a pleasure.
Ben Mandelkern produced and edited this conversation. It isn't over until you feed back on our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Leiden. Thank you for being part of the conversation.